of the most notorious series of murders in American history. Susan Jonasis is the author of Hell's Half Acre, The Untold Story of the Benders, a serial killer family on the American frontier. Susan joins us from her home in London. Susan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hello, and thank you so much for having me.
Most Kansans have at least a passing acquaintance with the story of the Benders, but for those who haven't heard about this horrific chapter in Kansas history, give us a quick overview.
Of course. So the Benders were a family of German spiritualists who murdered at least 11 people in Labette County, Kansas during the time that they lived there in the early 1870s. And then as concern at the number of disappearances in the area grew and people started to look towards the Benders as a potential suspect, they fled the state, abandoned their cabin and disappeared. And then about a month later, the extent of their crimes was discovered at the cabin, as you said, and that sparked a nationwide manhunt for the Benders, along with a media frenzy that lasted for decades after the crimes were discovered.
At the heart of this story is the daughter, Kate Bender. Describe Kate.
By all sensible contemporary accounts, because they do vary wildly, Kate Bender was a young woman between 20 and 25. She had quite a sharp face, but she was considered attractive. That was part of why people liked her, liked to go out to the cabin to visit her. She had long red hair and she was quite small and slight. But the thing that really drew people to her was that she practiced spiritualism and she had lofty dreams of becoming a famous medium. So she would often go into local towns and give lectures on spiritualism and free loveism. And she also had a reputation for being quite difficult if you turned down her offers of helping to heal you via magnetic healing. So by the time the murders were discovered, she was already a bit of a contentious figure in the community, but that's also part of why there was so much interest in the aftermath of the discovery of the crimes, because she was this really enigmatic figure that had suddenly become something even bigger than what she was.
Can you describe her relationship with the rest of the family?
So the relationship between the Benders is actually something that we can't quite be sure of. I feel like she was almost certainly related to Ma Bender, as in she was Ma Bender's daughter. But though she and John Gebhardt were passing themselves off as siblings, from the way their relationship is described in sources from the time, I think it's far more likely that they were married, or at least common law married, which I imagine was also the relationship between the older couple.
I'm visiting with Susan Jonasis. She's the author of Hell's Half Acre, The Untold Story of the Benders, a serial killer family on the American frontier. Susan, you tell the story of several people who lost their lives at the hand of the Bender family. Did any one of them stand out for you?
The one that stood out to me immediately, kind of at the start of my research, was George Lonker and his little daughter, Marianne. And I think that's another reason why people were so appalled at the crimes, because the evidence suggested that she'd been buried alive. And with the exception of Marianne, the rest of the victims were men. So she really stood out in that as well. And her father's backstory is deeply tragic. He had been married to a woman who lost a baby, and then she gave birth to Marianne, and then she died. And at the time they were murdered, they were actually relocating to Iowa so that he could be with Marianne's grandparents and she'd have more of a family system to support her. So that was a really devastating story. But one of the most interesting, and actually the story that came to be sort of the most emotionally close for me, was Mary York, who is the wife of William York, whose disappearance really sparked the discovery of what the Benders were doing. And she wrote in 1875 a very detailed account of her experiences and her relationship with William, her work as a nurse in the Civil War, William's relationship with his children, and just the absolute kind of heartache that she went through over the period that he was missing, and also how important her faith was to her throughout the whole thing. And she just has such a distinctive voice, and she just desperately loved her husband and was very angry at the way that she was treated in the aftermath of the crimes. So that became for me a real emotional touchstone of the book.
Susan, some of the Benders' victims were clearly murdered for their money, that robbery was a motive, but not all of them. Besides robbery, did you get a sense of the motive?
The motive is another interesting question. I felt like in my research, it became more and more obvious that they were mostly after horses, because they were involved in a wider network of horse thieves who were operating between Indian Territory, Texas, Kansas, and Colorado. And most of the men who arrived at the cabin did so on horses. Some of them were considered to be very nice horses because witnesses who later reported seeing these animals at an earlier date commented on how nice these animals were. But I also think there was definitely somebody in the family who enjoyed the violence, because obviously there are other ways to steal horses, and that this is not necessarily the easiest way to do it. So I'm of the belief that John Gebhardt was probably the driving force behind committing the murders, because he enjoyed them and they were an easy way to access what the family were after, and that the family themselves were probably career criminals who were more than happy to be complicit in his behavior.
I'm visiting with Susan Jonas. She's the author of Hell's Half Acre, The Untold Story of the Benders, a Serial Killer Family on the American Frontier. Susan, you're obviously British. As I mentioned, you live in London. How did you become interested in this story, which took place 150 years ago, more than 4,000 miles away?
I have always been interested in crime and the representation of criminals in popular culture, both in America and in the UK. And I studied that at university. That was something I pursued academically. I first read about the Benders in a big book that I bought in a thrift shop, which was like a collection of lots of different crimes. And that was the story that really stood out to me. It was completely unique. It had such interesting people at the heart of it, but it also didn't have an ending. There didn't seem to be that much information about it. And over the years, I sort of did a bit of casual research, and eventually I just thought, you know what? I really want to know more about everything involved in this. I think I'm now equipped enough to be able to do that. And that was ultimately why I decided to write the book.
What kind of challenges did you face researching the Bender murders with fresh eyes after all this time?
One of the major challenges when you're dealing with a crime that's this old, is that, one, there might not be that many sources. That was fortunately, not the case with this. It turned out there were hundreds and hundreds of primary documents related to the case at the Kansas State Archives. But one of the big issues is separating fact from fiction, especially at the time. Lots of the newspapers were reporting all sorts of different things. At first glance, the Benders, it appears, could have murdered 150 people and thrown knives at a woman who came to visit the house, which obviously we know is not the case. But you have to be able to sift through this information and compare them with other sources. So that is a very complicated process, in that you might find an account that you think is really good, and then you start checking it against other sources, and it becomes apparent very quickly that maybe it's not useful in the sense that it has factual information, but it's important in understanding the folklore surrounding the crimes. So it's about trying to walk that balance between reporting the facts and the narrative of the case accurately, but not discounting the volume of folklore that surrounds these murders and making sure to note that as part of why they've become so famous.
I'm so glad you brought up the number of newspaper accounts of the Bender murders at the time. I just want to take a note of some of the newspapers reporting on it that you cite: the Leavenworth Daily Commercial, the Headlight, the Kansas Democrat, the Osage County Chronicle, the Wyandotte Herald, the South Kansas Tribune. Talk about the role that the newspapers played at the time in sort of developing this story and some of the frenzy surrounding the Bender murders.
So the newspapers, there are a couple of very key newspapers like the Headlight out of Thayer, which were actually reporting on the disappearances kind of before the real frenzy surrounding the crimes kicked off. And they tend to be, when compared with other sources, a lot more reliable. And then you see, after William York disappeared, more regional newspapers start picking up the story. More people join the search party because they're obviously exposed to the information. And then by the time the crimes are discovered, it reaches a perfect fever pitch of just interest in where William York's gone, because they had reported William dead before his body was actually discovered. And so that in itself had really whipped the area up into a frenzy, because it was obvious there were perpetrators somewhere. They just had to find them. And then as soon as the bodies were found, I mean, you're looking at thousands and thousands of words printed about the Benders in the first month in newspapers all across the state. And some of them are just repeating other articles and adding a bit more information. Some of it's really good, interesting journalism. There's an account from a man who watched a neighbor of the Benders get lynched, and that's a really incredible piece of writing. And we know that happened from other reports. But the newspapers were responsible for the sheer volume of people who descended on the crime scene in the week after the bodies were discovered. And that, for me, was really interesting as well, because the local railroad put on extra trains so that people could come and see the crime scene. And the cabin was essentially torn apart by people who wanted to take it away as souvenirs. And I think the role of the papers in kind of encouraging that behavior just really can't be ignored.
In fact, you take the title of your book, Hell's Half Acre, from one of those newspaper accounts.
Yes, so it's from an article written on the 16th of May, which was about a week and a half after the crimes were discovered. And there are lots of other things that people called the Bender cabin. They called it the Garden of Death, the Devil's Kitchen. But this particular title for me really stood out because it was actually a phrase that was in use before the Bender murders to describe areas of cities and towns that were considered dangerous. But it's also used to describe huge stretches of difficult landscape and dangerous areas of the wilderness. And I just thought, considering the overall direction of the narrative, that was the perfect title to kind of bring all those themes together.
The book is Hell's Half Acre, The Untold Story of the Benders, a Serial Killer Family on the American Frontier, by Susan Jonasis. Susan, most of the accounts that I've read about the Benders treat this as an isolated event, but you've spent some time setting the story in the context of the violence of Kansas and the frontier in the late 1800s. Do you see a link between these murders and the general lawlessness of the time?
I think so. And I think the crimes both kind of typify the sort of violence that was going on, but also are completely unique. I mean, you're looking at a period in time where communities are very close-knit, but there's also a lot of brawling. There's a lot of transient workers coming through. At one point in this case, the blame for the disappearances gets placed on a railroad town, which is considered to be sort of a pit of men who like to drink and fight. And then you see this kind of behavior all over the state. And you also see the citizens enacting their own form of justice against some of these people as well, in the form of lynch mobs. But the Bender crimes were extremely unique in that they were a kind of methodical hidden violence. They weren't, if you take Frank McPherson, for example, who was a man who I discovered was a close associate of the family. And he was a psychopath who attacked a baker after he tried to sexually assault the baker's wife. He killed that man. Over the course of his life, there are these isolated incidents of very intense violence. And I think people were a lot more used to that sort of behavior. That was sort of part and parcel for living out west. But the idea that a family were out on the prairie sort of quietly dispatching people who came through to ask them for shelter was just something completely unheard of, which is why, again, it was able to go on for so long.
And the fact that their house appeared to be set up specifically for that purpose. Can you describe their cabin and what would happen to their unwitting victims?
So the cabin was relatively small for cabins at that point in time. It had one room that was divided by either a wagon sheet or whatever fabric the family had at hand. And you would walk in the front and there'd be a big heavy walnut table and then some shelves with what the family sort of called their grocery store. But is described as never really being that well stocked. And then beyond the curtain, the family had the area where they'd sleep. And there was a straw mattress at one point, a pallet bed, and then this trap door that was just behind the curtain. So people would stop at the cabin because it was one of the few places you could stop on the road between places like Osage Mission and Independence. And the Benders had a good enough reputation that people would say, oh, you should stop at the Bender cabin. And obviously, because they didn't kill everybody who stayed with them, there was no real reason to suspect them initially. But they would have the person they were entertaining or feeding sit on the side of the table with their back to the curtain. And then while they were eating or while they were talking to Kate, another member of the family would hit them on the back of the head through the curtain. And then once they were stunned by that blow, they'd be bludgeoned around the temples and then finally have their throats cut. And then that trapdoor would be opened, down would go the victim, and the family could clean up relatively quickly in case anybody else stopped at the cabin. But they usually targeted men traveling alone, of course, with the exception of George and Marianne.
One thing that stood out to me in reading Hell's Half Acre was that people did sometimes just disappear in the West, and that there wasn't really much of a way to find your disappeared loved ones other than hiring a private investigator.
Yes, so, I mean, that was sort of part and parcel, I think, of risking trying to set a life up on the American frontier. I mean, some of the wives of the men who were killed just didn't, you know, they had young children, they were left on homesteads that they couldn't really run by themselves. One woman, her husband disappears while she's in New York, so there's no real reason for her to return to Kansas to look for him. She doesn't have the money to pay a private detective. And some people wandered into the wilderness and just didn't come back. Some people would be found, maybe they'd had an accident or become victim to brutal weather conditions. Other people would leave and then go on and live completely fine lives, but never get back in contact with their family. So I think this is again why there was no real initial panic that people started going missing, because that just happens sometimes.
I'm visiting with Susan Jonasis. She's the author of Hell's Half Acre, The Untold Story of the Benders, a Serial Killer Family on the American Frontier. Susan, you traveled to Kansas in doing your research for this book. Can you tell me about what it was like for you to be in this area?
So when I started writing the book, I knew that I couldn't do it without visiting Kansas. And part of that was the archives. Also part of it was knowing how important the location and the landscape was to the story. And so we spent a couple of days in Independence, where we then drove across to Cherryvale and visited the wonderful Cherryvale Historical Museum, where the Bender Hammers are still kept, along with a amazing wealth of other local history about the area. And we also drove up to where Big Hill Creek would have been. And we did our best to try and get near the land where the Bender cabin would have been. But we obviously don't know exactly where in the land it was. And we were reminded by a very nice man not to trespass. So we sort of looked at where it might have been from afar. But it was just a really amazing experience as well to have read so much about the area and its history, and then to visit. And you can really feel it. You can feel, you know, like all the struggles that people were going through. You can feel what they gave up. You can feel this huge landscape that they were sort of pushing against to try and make a life. And it was really special as well to visit the graves of some of the victims and know that even though they obviously died in extremely distressing circumstances, they were reburied and their families were able to do that. I was going to say, though, it was really interesting when we were in Kansas, actually, because even outside of, I expected people kind of around in Labette and Montgomery County to be aware of the crimes, and they certainly were. And, you know, we were offered various opinions on what might have happened to them. But even in places like Topeka, people were very aware of the crimes, and it was always that kind of select events that happened in 1873. That's the part of the story that sort of everybody knows. And that's the story that I was introduced to as well. That was the sort of information I was given. And the research for this honestly provided so much more than I ever thought it could have. You know, I never expected necessarily to be, as you sort of dream of finding what happened to them, but you also know with a case that's old, that's not that realistic. But to be able to trace them right into Texas and then to basically discover that, you know, it wasn't that they didn't know where they were, it's that they didn't have the funding, you know, they didn't have the cooperation between the states. All of that was really interesting. And I think, you know, we still see that in some places today. But yeah, it was a really rewarding research experience, actually, beyond what I sort of envisioned at the start.
Can I pick up on something you just said about being down in Texas? At one point, you say that we think we know where the Benders are down in Texas, but no one's going to be able to capture them without the help of the military. Why wasn't the military more willing to help track down this family?
This is one of the big questions that I would love to know the exact answer to, because with a case this big and high profile, you assume that people would absolutely jump at the chance to be involved in apprehending these people. I mean, that was why several of the detectives and people over the years went after the Benders when maybe they really shouldn't have, because it was genuinely incredibly dangerous. But none of these people who were essentially equipped to do it were fussed about it. I mean, the Texas authorities basically felt it was a problem for Kansas and they didn't want to waste their time on it. And I just found that really interesting. And I also was extremely surprised that, you know, there wasn't somebody somewhere who was willing to fund the search, go along with it, and then maybe reap the benefits of being involved in, you know, bringing such a horrible group of people to justice.
That makes me wonder how much of this was really driven by the economics, that none of the people that disappeared were wealthy or had the resources, and perhaps that area of Kansas just didn't have the resources to finance that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a kind of sad repeating pattern throughout history that it takes a very specific type of person to go missing before, you know, people are able to or do pay attention, because lots of, you know, family members I'm sure if they had the money would have looked for their loved ones immediately. But when William York disappeared, he obviously came from this big prestigious family that had several very successful businesses. His brother was a high profile, despite being controversial, politician. And so that family were really able to mobilize. But if William York hadn't gone missing, I mean, the Benders could have continued for years until they killed somebody else who was able to, you know, fund a search like that. And I think this particular area of Kansas, and you see this a lot on the frontier, there's a real boom and bust cycle that goes on. So independence was doing really well, but it was still definitely in its infancy at the time the crimes went on. So maybe there weren't people with enough money to kind of continually fund a search. Governor Osborne goes up for re-election, and he's so worried that he hasn't been able to catch the Benders that he then won't drop any more funds on the search because he feels it makes him look irresponsible. So it's all these little things that kind of come together in a bureaucratic nightmare that really hinder the search for the family.
I want to introduce two more characters into the Bender story. That's Leroy Dick and Francis McCann.
Yes, so Leroy Dick was a township trustee at the time of the murders, and his role in both the crimes and his role in the discovery of the crimes, but then his role in the arrest of two women in 1889 is really interesting because his sort of personal connection with the case and his willingness to talk about it and his tendency to kind of mythologize his own role had a big impact on what was written about the Benders sort of in the early 20th century, because he loved to talk about it. And then Francis McCann is one of the most interesting people I've ever come across sort of in any of my studies. So Francis was a woman who was orphaned as a child and then married as she moved out of the orphanage. But she considered herself to be kind of a psychic detective. And through a very weird chain of events, she decided that a woman she had hired to help her do her laundry was actually Kate Bender. And this was obviously quite a while after the crimes. And she, together with Leroy Dick, kind of brought a case against this woman, Sarah, and her mother, Almira, that very nearly did get them prosecuted as being the Bender women, when really, as soon as you look properly into the circumstances of these women's lives, there's no real indicator that they were the Benders. And one of them was in prison at the time of the murders. The other one had lost a child. That's all on record. But Leroy Dick and Francis's kind of determination to finally close this chapter of Kansan history was just something that I found both interesting and also a bit baffling. I really don't know what was going on with Frances McCann. I think she was a very complicated woman, obviously with a lot of her own trauma. But it was quite a weird case to latch onto in that respect. And I think Leroy Dick felt a considerable amount of guilt that he hadn't acted faster back in 1872, 1873. And this, taking part in the arrest of these women allowed him to kind of assuage some of that guilt. And he could feel like, I did finally catch them. And then it wasn't my fault that they were let go.
Why do you think we are still so fascinated with this gruesome story 150 years later?
I think it's a combination of things. I think Kate plays a huge role in that. I think her kind of enigmatic behavior. We don't have any images of her. We don't really know what she looked like. She's sort of a canvas that people can paint in their own ideas. And I think that's very appealing when you're looking at a case like this. I think the sheer unusualness of a family of serial killers really stands the test of time. There aren't really many other instances like that. And we can really feel the kind of influence, direct or indirect, on popular culture. So many shows have included the Benders. I mean, there's an episode of Supernatural which makes reference to them. Characters based on them appear in Red Dead Redemption 2. I think they're even mentioned in a Neil Gaiman novel as inspiration for some characters in that. So they really, there's just something about them that gripped the popular consciousness. And I also think it's the fact that they escaped. I mean, they did never see justice. And we are very fixated with stories that offer no closure, because I think there's a hope that one day, somehow, with the help of divine intervention, we'll find that piece of evidence that explains everything.
I've been visiting with Susan Jonasis. She's the author of Hell's Half Acre, The Untold Story of the Benders, a Serial Killer Family on the American Frontier. Susan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hell's Half Acre was just named one of the Great Reads from Great Places, one of two books that the National Center for the Book chose to represent Kansas. The second book, One Boy Watching, by Grant Snyder of Wichita. We'll hear from him as KPR Presents continues right after this. From the University of Kansas, we are Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 Lawrence and 91.3 Olsburg, Junction City. Tell your smart speaker to play Kansas Public Radio. Tonight's encore broadcast of Live at Green Lady Lounge features the Tim Whitmer Good Time Quartet. The fun is contagious whenever this band is in the house, and you'll hear them tonight at 9 o'clock, right after the Retro Cocktail Hour on Kansas Public Radio. Welcome back to KPR Presents. I'm Kay McIntyre. On today's program, Great Reads from Great Places. Each year, in connection with the National Book Festival, the National Center for the Book picks two books to represent each state. We've just heard from Susan Jonasis, author of Hell's Half Acre. And now, the second book representing Kansas. It's One Boy Watching, a picture book by author, illustrator, and cartoonist Grant Snyder of Wichita. Snyder is the creator of Incidental Comics and has written and illustrated several books, including What Sound Is Morning, I Will Judge You by Your Bookshelf, and his latest, Poetry Comics. Our conversation about his book, One Boy Watching, was originally broadcast on July 3rd, 2022.
I was a bus rider as a kid, from kindergarten through about 10th grade, I think, whenever I got my high school car and it was too cool to ride the bus anymore. But I had always had these really vivid memories of riding the bus, but had never really incorporated them into any artwork. But when I set out to write a new picture book proposal a few years back, those memories of being on a bus riding through the Kansas countryside came back to me so vividly. And I basically made the story of a boy being picked up early in the morning, first on the bus route, riding throughout the fields and farmlands around where I went to school, Mulvane, Kansas, seeing as the bus fills up with loud kids, all the while he's looking at the window, taking in the sights and sounds and thinking about things. So it was a great way for me to use those memories to make something new, to revisit those places that I'd been through so many times as a grown-up and draw and sketch and write about them. And I really think it's a nice reflection of what being a passenger on any kind of ride, whether a school bus, an airplane, a normal bus ride, will feel like to the writer.
Can you describe the process that you went through when you tried to recreate those memories?
Well, different than most of the time, I started out by just writing about it. So usually, like I mentioned, the words and pictures are forming together, but I basically just wrote down everything I could remember about all these different experiences on the bus. The time we veered into a ditch and the bus was turned at a 45 degree angle and we had to be unloaded and onto another bus. The times where we get stopped behind a train and I'd be worried, oh, I'm going to be late for school. You know, kind of that simultaneous fear and excitement about that. What people would draw and write on the windows even though the bus driver was yelling at us not to do that, even down to like the soundtrack, like the songs we'd hear on 90s pop radio or like the country music stations at the time, depending on the driver. So, and obviously a bunch of memories is not a story in itself, but it was really the basis for it. From that, I stumbled upon, when working with my editor, the idea of counting. So instead of just a straightforward narrative, it's the boy on the bus looking out the window and counting what he sees. And that's sort of like a meditation on the process of observing, but it's also, I think, an interesting way to move the story along and connect these ideas together.
Grant, could I have you read a couple pages from One Boy Watching?
Sure. 7 a.m. One boy waiting for two bright headlights. Bus number 4, 3 big steps up. 28 empty seats. 1 unfogged window. 1 boy watching. And then it goes on to the rest of the route as other kids are getting picked up and eventually the destination of school.
That's Grant Snyder reading from One Boy Watching, his latest children's picture book. Grant, on a personal note, I love that you described what the other kids on the bus were doing, and especially the fact that you included a girl on the bus that was feeling car sick. One of my most vivid memories of when I rode the bus to school was a girl getting sick on the bus. And when I read that in your book, that took me back so powerfully to the sort of like horror and glee that the kids on the bus had about, you know, something different is happening, even if it's something gross and icky and you feel sorry for this girl, but also it's kind of exciting.
Yeah, it's something unusual on the day that's you remember years and years later. Maybe I shouldn't say this, but that was a real person who sat by me in kindergarten, and she didn't ride the bus for very long because, yeah, she couldn't take that. So I assume at some point she might read this book. I apologize in advance for including her. But yeah, I think everyone has those really specific memories of riding the school bus because, for one thing, it's something you did every day. It's kind of mundane. You saw the same things out the window every time. There were the same people who came, but there were always these unusual things, not always necessarily positive. I mean, there were the loud teenagers in the back. There was, you know, sometimes you'd get sat next to a mean kid who, you know, you kind of dreaded being on the bus with them. But everybody has, I think, those really specific, vivid memories that they can, go back to from their experience on the school bus.
It also occurs to me that the school bus holds a very particular place in your imagination as a kid, that you're going from home to school, which are two big places in your world at that point, and that this is the transition from one world to another world and back again.
I love that observation, yeah. And I wish I could have used that in the book. But yeah, it's almost like your first solo journey outside of the home. To another somewhat safe and familiar place at school, but you are really going off into the unknown in a way, especially the kindergartner or first grader who's on the bus for the first time, not quite sure what to expect, thrown in there with a bunch of bigger kids that are completely unfamiliar. So yeah, maybe that's why it's such a, evokes such vivid memories. It's that first setting out from the comfort of home.
Grant, how did you come to drawing?
So I always drew growing up, like most future illustrators would say. Was always with a pen or pencil or paints in my hand as a kid. Never quite figured out how I would use it later on in life until I was at the University of Kansas and started drawing for the Daily Kansan my junior year. Had in a strip 5 days a week and really got the bug for cartooning, for seeing the process of new ideas take shape. And that's really what got me into drawing cartoons, and I just kept doing it.
And for people who attended the University of Kansas at the same time that you did, give us a sense of what years we're talking about and what they might remember about the cartoons that you drew for the Daily Kansas.
So a lot of them are very forgettable, so hopefully not many remembered. But this would have been, I think, 2007 was the year that I pretty much exclusively drew that strip. Before I maybe had a couple, and that was my last year at KU. But I think the one that's most memorable to me was illustrations for a piece in the newspaper about comparison between KU and K-State, kind of a ridiculous humor piece. And it was posted online and it kind of went viral when that was still becoming a thing. unfortunately, at some point, like, the website crashed. And I don't think you can go back and see all the angry comments from, you know, from rival fans. But yeah, looking back, I still get a kick at those drawings, you know, comparing like the red and blue of KU with Superman to the purple of K-State with Barney the dinosaur. I mean, kind of juvenile type humor, but pretty funny at the time.
Apologies to all of our listeners in Manhattan right now.
Yeah, I hold no ill will towards any other school in the state of Kansas.
By night, you are an illustrator. By day, you're an orthodontist. Talk to me about how your two worlds work together, or do they?
Yeah, so about the time I was discovering that I love to draw comics and cartoons, I also got into dental school and started doing that. So they basically were parallel tracks that, you know, kept growing together. My current schedule, I work a few days as an orthodontist and a couple of days at home drawing and writing books. Soon I'm changing to 3 days drawing and writing and the last 2 days of the week working on teeth. So it's always been an interesting balance, but I feel like it's pretty rewarding because it gets me outside of my head a little bit, lets my subconscious work better, gives me a break from the drawing table. And I think that does feed into the work and make it more enjoyable when I do sit down to work on my ideas.
Again, I'm visiting with Grant Snyder. He's the author of One Boy Watching and The Art of Living. Grant, you have 5 children of your own. How do they play into how you write your books or how you live a mindful life?
Yeah, that's an interesting question because my first reaction is that like 5 children, especially young ages, are the anti-mindfulness. but that's not quite true. So yeah, it's very chaotic and there's a lot of commotion in my house. Everything, it's always very loud. But I do think, especially in quiet individual moments, I'm really see them as almost like a teacher of mindfulness and attention. So I describe like walking down the block with a 2 or 3 year old as one of the most mindful activities you can do. As a grown up, I'm basically trying to shuffle them on to the next activity of the day. My brain is elsewhere. I'm thinking about, you know, those obligations, which are always present. And meanwhile, my 2 year old son or daughter is focused on exactly what's in front of them, exactly what's on the walk, picking up a leaf, throwing a rock, jumping in a puddle, swinging a stick. It's all the interaction with the natural world because everything is brand new and unfamiliar to them. And when I'm able to like tear myself away from parent brain and you know, put myself in the mind of this toddler, that's a really rewarding and valuable experience. One I think has filtered into a few of my comic strips and I think would actually be a great topic for a kid's book of its own. So the hard part is going from being dad to going to, okay, I want to experience the world like my young child is experiencing it. Yeah, it's a big challenge.
How does writing a children's book like One Boy Watching different than writing and drawing your poetry comics?
It's almost like a marathon versus a sprint, or I guess I've only ran a half marathon, so we'll go with a half marathon. So the comics that make up The Art of Living, I Will Judge You by Your Bookshelf, and my other collection, The Shape of Ideas, were all drawn individually. So I do one page, which takes me 2 or 3 days, sometimes a week at the most. When I'm working on a children's picture book, they're between 32 and 50 pages in total. So that's going to take about 6 months to a year. I'm spending a lot more time with a single idea. I can't say, oh, I'm kind of tired of this idea. I need to move on to the next thing. I really have to immerse myself in the world. So where my comic strips are really following an idea to its natural conclusion, creating a picture book for me is more like immersing myself into a world, figuring out the visual style, figuring out how to create the world on paper, and crafting a story that's going to take the reader across those 32 to 50 pages and lead to that same satisfying conclusion. Yeah, it's a much more slower paced, inefficient, for me more challenging because I haven't done as many of them, but still a really, really rewarding thing. And yeah, hopefully that enjoyment in the process comes through in the finished work.
Do you have one form that you like more than the other?
I do consider the comics more like my first language. When I write a picture book, it's almost like I've gone to a country where I can sort of read the language, but can't quite fluently speak it yet. So, and maybe someday that'll change. Maybe someday I'll feel fluent at that medium and at that form of expression. But I think it's kind of fun in a way to not be as familiar with it because my brain's more open to experimentation. It's like the beginner's mind, I think, is the term I'd use for that. You don't know the limits. You don't know the constraints yet. So you almost feel free to do anything you want to do. And that's how I feel when I create a children's picture book. The flip side of that is it's scary because there's fewer limits and guardrails. So you don't quite know how to get started or take the project along.
Grant, you're describing this as if you hadn't actually written several children's books, but in fact, not only did you write One Boy Watching, which has just come out, but she wrote The Sound of Morning, What Color is Night? How similar are those books to One Boy Watching?
So they both have the poetic meditative aspect, but they don't really feature a character. It's more like a omniscient viewpoint going through night and morning. It was fun to include a character that moves through the book, and I think that definitely connects the reader more to it. But I do feel like with every new book project, I'm starting from scratch, from square one. I going back in feeling like I know nothing about it, like I've never done anything before. And from what I've heard from even more veteran writers and illustrators, that never changes. So, you know, you're never going to wake up and be like, oh, I have this mastered. I know exactly how to do this. There would be no room for exploration, discovery, and wonder in the process. So maybe it's a good thing that, you know, you always feel like a little bit of a beginner when you sit down to make a new story.
Grant, the colors in your work are so vivid. How do you capture that much color?
Yeah, so I really enjoy the coloring. It's funny, my 8-year-old has read some of my work. I showed him this latest book. The first thing he said was, Dad, when are you going to do something that's funny? Because he's used to, you know, Dog Man and Diary of a Wimpy Kid and these hilarious comic strips a lot of kids read. The next thing he said was more of a compliment. It was, Dad, I really like the colors in this one. So, yeah, I think that that's kind of the last piece I put together when I'm making a page. But I really want the colors to capture the mood of the words, the mood of the pictures, and also really draw the reader's eye in. In some of the other pages, I experiment with like watercolor, or I've even cut out like pieces of construction paper and glued them together. And that's a much more like improvisational thing. So instead of dropping colors in on the computer with Photoshop, I'm just cutting up and tearing paper and feel like really like a kid at the art table again, you know, making a new creation.
Has your drawing style changed over the years?
Yeah, every time I scroll back through my blog archives, which go back to probably 2009, it's kind of terrifying because it looks like it's drawn by a different person. And when I read the words, it's like it's written by a different person. So that's the natural evolution of any character, any strip you're drawing over time. It's going to look night and day different over time, but the change is so gradual you don't see it happening. So I think it's become looser. It's become a little freer, a bit more sketchy, but it still retains the same essence, I think. So right now I'm focusing more on the shorter work. And I do like the form of poetry and its intersection with comics. It does keep it short and simple, like we've been focusing on here. But someday it may be something I want to try once I have the idea for that wide-ranging story or topic.
Grant, thank you so much for coming in today.
Yeah, thank you, Kay. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Grant Snyder is the author of One Boy Watching. It was one of two books selected to represent Kansas this year as Great Reads from Great Places. For the rest of this hour, we'll revisit another great read from Great Places, The Chicken Sisters by K.J. Dell'Antonia. It was named a Great Reads from Great Places in 2022 and a Kansas Notable Book in 2021. The Chicken Sisters tells the story of two competing chicken restaurants, Chicken Mimi's and Chicken Franny's. But any good Kansan will see the obvious reference to Chicken Mary's and Chicken Annie's in southeast Kansas.
My dad is from Pittsburgh and my mom is from Frontenac. Any good Kansan will know that Chicken Annie's and Chicken Mary's are not in the same towns. One's in Frontenac and one's in Pittsburgh. And I grew up, I was born in Texas, although I went to high school in Kansas. And my parents lived in Texas when I was young, and I grew up going back and forth to Pittsburgh and Frontenac to see my family. And we would always eat at Chicken Annie's because we were a Chicken Annie's family. And at that time, you didn't do both. You did one or the other. I've eaten at Chicken Mary's once, very daring experience that, you know, it's possible there were people in my family who couldn't be informed about. So I have enjoyed them both. And I just grew up knowing that these exist. I mean, they were sort of really central to my, every time we went, we would go. And we weren't, I mean, I was also a child who thought Taco Bell was a big deal. That was my birthday choice. So this is not something I did a lot of. So to go to that restaurant was a huge deal. So I was always curious about, as I got older, like, why would there be two chicken restaurants that are unrelated with basically the same name? And it just stayed in my head for a long time. And my parents moved away, I moved away, I went to K-State, but moved away after that, and just, they stayed in my head. And when it came to writing fiction, those were what was still in there. I mean, I had experimented and done some other stuff, but the thing that really came out was surrounding those chicken restaurants. And I remember telling my mom that I was going to write about Chicken Annie's and Chicken Mary's, and she was like, "Do you want to hear the real story?" And I was like, "Nope. Do not tell me the real story." So actually, I don't even know what she was going to tell me. I need to ask her. Fortunately, the Chicken Mary's and Chicken Annie's people love the book. I was a little worried about that, but it worked out really well. And then, of course, I had to change the names, which was hard for me because I was so attached to the original names. Chicken Franny's does look like a combination of Chicken Annie's and a restaurant called Babe's that's in Texas. And then Chicken Mimi's is totally, it's not either restaurant because it's a chicken shack. It's not really a restaurant. It's very different. Anyway, they liked them, fortunately.
In your version of the Chicken Sisters, you update the competition by bringing in a little reality TV.
Yes. As it turns out, Chicken Annie's and Chicken Mary's did do a reality TV, a little chicken face-off, like 15 years ago or something like that, which I've not watched. I should go back and do it. But I don't think it was not the heated competition that I invented. So one of the fun things about writing fiction is that you can make things up, which is also why I made up my own town, so I could put the restaurants closer together and change a lot of things. It's a much smaller town than the real Pittsburgh. And I invented this TV, this competition, in which there would also be an element of social media so that they were putting things out immediately because I needed them to be getting an immediate response to the things that were happening so that rather than the normal social, the normal reality TV thing would be that they would film it and then 3 months later they would play it and no one would know who had won. And I needed, you know, an immediate involvement from the audience. So I revised it in that way. But yes, and it's really not a competition between two restaurants. It's a competition between two sisters.
Can I have you read an excerpt from the book in which one of the sisters is trying to get the Food Channel interested?
Yes. So the book starts with an ad from the Food Channel, TFC, and it says, "The hit TFC series Food Wars is back, and this time it's personal. We're looking for rival restaurants with a deeper connection, married chefs, best friends with dueling taco trucks. If you're a restaurant owner or worker who shares a bond with the crew at a competing restaurant in your town, we want to hear from you." Then it details the competition in which you're going to win a significant sum of money. So the book is about two sisters, one who stayed and one who went, essentially. And that's really at the core of the story. So this is the sister who stayed, and she is going to write the producer at the Food Channel. And she says, "To Sabrina Sky at thefoodchannel.com from Amanda Pogacello at gmail.com. Subject, The Chicken Sisters, application for Food Wars. Chicken Mimi's fried chicken is pan-fried and people love it. Chicken Franny's fried chicken is deep-fat fried and people love it too. I am probably the only person in the world who knows how both are made, but I never make either. I hate chicken. I mean, I like chickens, but I don't like to eat them. I've been a vegetarian since I was 6. I grew up working the counter for my mother, who ran Mimi's, which was started by my great-great-grandmother. Now, a hostess for my mother-in-law at Franny's, which was started by my husband's great-great-grandmother, my dead husband. There should be a word for that. Like ex-husband, it would be easier. Now, there's a word limit on these applications, so at this point, Amanda realizes that she's way over. So she tries again. Draft. My name is Amanda Pogicello. I am a hostess at Chicken Franny's, just outside Marinette, Kansas. That's my imaginary town. Our rival Chicken Mimi's is right on Main Street. The restaurants were started by two sisters who hated each other in the late 1800s, one mostly for people on trains passing through, and the other mostly for the men who worked in the coal mines. For over 100 years, people around here have been choosing one or the other. Loyalty gets passed down in families, even. Only newcomers eat at both, although not very many people actually sit down and eat at Mimi's anymore. They just get their chicken and go home. The sisters' feud lasted until their deaths, and it's still going. Nobody from Franny's is allowed into Mimi's, and vice versa. Chicken Mimi's thinks Chicken Franny's is pretentious and stuffy because we have a fancy bar and a large menu of more than just fried chicken. Mimi's serves chicken, biscuits, fried potatoes, iceberg lettuce salad, and pie. That's it. It's not even a real restaurant. It's a chicken shack with tables. At Franny's, we think that's ridiculous. We think Mimi's needs to grow up and take things seriously and definitely clean itself up. Mimi's thinks Franny's could just let people seat themselves and relax. And then the last draft is Amanda again, and she says, please pick us. We're dying out here.
That's KJ Del Antonio reading from The Chicken Sisters. It was named a Kansas Notable Book. It was also chosen by the National Center for the Book for their Great Reads from Great Places program. KJ, what is it about The Chicken Sisters that you think says Kansas?
That has been funny because it was not intentional. I did not realize that I was writing such a deeply Kansas book. Well, obviously those chicken restaurants are iconic for anyone who's ever gone through southern Kansas. I mean, it's very unique and people are proud. Like, you don't know about them unless you're from Kansas, and that itself becomes a thing. And then I think that the relationships in here, that idea of the ones who stay and the ones who go, that's very Kansas. It's very small town. I think it's very Midwestern, that question of do you stay here or do you hit one of the coasts.
KJ Del Antonio is the author of The Chicken Sisters. It was a 2022 selection as a great read from Great Places. The Chicken Sisters has been adapted for the small screen and is expected to premiere on Hallmark Plus in September. My conversation with KJ Del Antonio was recorded at the Kansas Book Festival in September 2022. This year's Kansas Book Festival will be Saturday, September 28th at Washburn University in Topeka. It's free and open to the public. For more information and a complete schedule, including my Q&A with mystery author Sarah Paretsky, go to kansasbookfestival.com. I'm Kay McIntyre. KPR Presents is a production of Kansas Public Radio at the University of Kansas.
Support for KPR Presents comes from Kansas Tree Care, local arborists who provide professional tree care in the Greater Lawrence area, and who can be reached at kansastreecare.com or at 785-843-TREE. And Green Lady Lounge, featuring Kansas City jazz music, cocktails, wine, and beer. Live Kansas City jazz 365 days a year till 3 a.m. Information at greenladylounge.com. From the University of Kansas, it's your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio, KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence, FM 91.5, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia, FM 89.7, KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City, FM 91.3, KANQ Chanute, FM 90.3, and online at kansaspublicradio.org.
It has been a year since Lahaina lost more than 100 people to the devastating wildfires in West Maui. Residents have leaned into community to get by, but morale is waning.
It's still a very strong air of uncertainty.
Yeah, I mean, if I sit down and really think about the future, it really is, you know, kind of paralyzing.
We'll check in for an update on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Here's a look at the KPR weather forecast.
It's 77 and cloudy.
Wind is from the northeast at 5 to 10 miles per hour.
Tonight, a few showers with a low in the upper 60s.
Wind will be from the northeast at 5 to 10 miles per hour.
Then tomorrow, clear with a high in the mid 80s.
Wind will be from the east at 5 to 10 miles per hour.
Tomorrow night, thunderstorms with a low in the mid-60s.
It's 77 and cloudy.
Stay tuned for more KPR weather. I'm Maria Lopez.
You're listening to the Retro Cocktail Hour.
That's guitar wizard Buddy Merrill and a tune called Strings on Fire, lighting a match to this round of the Retro Cocktail Hour. I'm Daryl Brogdon, and here is where the music is always served up shaken, not stirred, except no substitutes. We're on the air and on the web from here at the Underground Martini Bunker. Coming up, the potent percussion of Don Catelli, not his real name. Also, Buddy Collette and the Latin All-Stars from the classic jazz heat Bongo Beat. Henry Mancini from Mr. Lucky Goes Latin. The exotic sounds of Jazztronic, Rita Calypso, and Martin Denny. Plus, music inspired by this humble radio show. It's all killer, no filler, on the Retro Cocktail Hour from Kansas Public Radio.
Ooh, 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 ooh,
Esquivel and his orchestra from the late 1950s with Point Siena here on the Retro Cocktail Hour. That comes from the E-Man's U.S. debut, Other Worlds, Other Sounds. Welcome to the Retro Cocktail Hour, the home of space age pop and incredibly strange music. Daryl Brogdon here, and we'll get around to Mr. Lucky Goes Latin in this half hour, plus Les Baxter's classic Soul of the Drums. Next, the Francis Bay Big Band. He was a Belgian trombonist who worked in a number of European bands throughout the 1940s and later wrote music for Dutch and German films. At the 1958 World's Fair in Brussels, the Bay Big Band got some international attention, and that led to a bunch of records for the Omega label in the U.S. His first album in the States was called Latin Beat and went for kind of a Perez Prado sound. Here's the Bay Big Band and Mangoes on the Retro Cocktail Hour, Kansas Public Radio.
We'll be right back. Thank you.
From one of the great bongo records, that's flutist Buddy Collette with the Latin All-Stars and the title tune, Jazz Heat Bongo Beats, here on the Retro Cocktail Hour. This was done for Crown Records, and if you've listened to the show before, you know I love to talk about Crown Records, one of the big budget labels of the 1950s and 60s. They mostly did generic music, knockoffs of current hits, or deceptive artist names, which were meant to confuse the undiscriminating record buyer. But occasionally, they did release some original stuff, and here's a case where they really struck gold. This is a tremendous album, Jazz Heat Bongo Beat, down around 1960. Also, Don Catelli and his All-Stars, which is really the Francis Bay Big Band again, with Say CC, music from Potent Percussion. Before that, Quartet Trebien, a band led by pianist Jeter Thompson, who is still leading a version of this group. They came out of St. Louis in the 1960s, and we heard them on Voodoo Man. Thanks for joining us here at the Underground Martini Bunker for the Retro Cocktail Hour. I'm Daryl Brogdon with Henry Mancini, vibist Cal Jeter, and Rita Calypso still to come. Here's one now from Les Baxter and his orchestra. This is on Soul of the Drums, an album done in the early 1960s for Frank Sinatra's Reprise label. It's Coffee Bean and Calabash Annie on the Retro Cocktail Hour from KPR. Henry Mancini from Mr. Lucky Goes Latin with Raindrops in Rio here on the Retro Cocktail Hour. This is one of those go-to albums that belongs in everybody's record collection. Great stuff. Inspired by a TV series that only lasted one season in 1959. Here we are again at the Underground Martini Bunker for the Retro Cocktail Hour. I'm Daryl Brogdon. I imagine you're relaxing in your martini bunker right now, aren't you? And you know the martini bunker can be a state of mind as well as place, right? So maybe you're at work right now, goofing off to this show. We won't tell the boss. Still to come, we've got a tune by composer Andrew Morgan that's inspired at least in part by listening to the Retro Cocktail Hour. That's in our next half hour. Here's music now by Alberto Baldon Bembo, a gifted Italian composer who's done scores for a bunch of movies and quite a few records as well. From the album Smart Set, here's a lovely tune called Green Sea. Dive in on the Retro Cocktail Hour, Kansas Public Radio.
the Tiki Shack is shaken on the Retro Cocktail Hour, a production of Kansas Public Radio.
Support for the Retro Cocktail Hour on KPR comes from the Lawrence Music Alliance's Mix Master Music Conference, Saturday, September 7th at Lawrence Public Library. Music industry workshops and panels, as well as a health clinic. Tickets at mixmaster2024.com. And Blue Collar Press, located in Lawrence, Kansas. Blue Collar Press helps businesses and creatives build their brands through merchandising, from design to production to fulfillment. More at bluecollarpress.com. That is a tune called Voyage to Scorpion Island by Andrew Morgan here on the Retro Cocktail Hour. Andrew lives in Lawrence, Kansas. I first heard from him a while back when he sent me this tune, which he says is partly inspired by listening to the Retro Cocktail Hour. You can buy a copy of it online at bandcamp.com. It's just a gorgeous tune with echoes of Martin Denny and Les Baxter. And thank you, Andrew Morgan, for sharing it with all of us. I look forward to your first full Exotica record. Also in that set, vibist Cal Jater and Antonio Carlos Jobim's A Felicidade from the CD Fried Bananas. Daryl Brogdon here. You're listening to the Retro Cocktail Hour. Later in the hour, something new by Jazztronic from a CD called Aloha Exotica. And if that title alone doesn't set your ears on fire, well, stay tuned. They'll be smoking soon. Next up, Rita Calypso, a.k.a. singer Ana Lan. This is from an album called Apocalypso, which came out on the Spanish label Siesta back in 2002. Now, according to the album, Rita is a femme fatale with lush, pouty lips and dark hair. A man-eater given to ravishing multi-millionaire lovers on Mexico's Costa Azul. I think I'm in love. Here's Rita and the Disadvantages of You on the Retro Cocktail Hour, Kansas Public Radio. From 2013 and a CD entitled Lava Lounge, that's Steve Wingfield with the I Dream of Jeannie theme, composed by Hugo Montenegro. Apparently there are lyrics for that theme, although I'm not sure anybody's ever recorded them. This is the Retro Cocktail Hour. I'm Daryl Brogdon, and we are on the air again from here at the Underground Martini Bunker. Still to come, Robert Drasnin from Voodoo 2, Martin Denny from Exotica 2, and Bing Crosby. We're on the air every week on stations like Northwest Public Radio, WSKG in Binghamton, New York, WKMS in Murray, Kentucky, and Radio New Zealand. Hello to any Kiwis listening in. And if you miss us on the radio, well, you can always catch up by listening on demand at retrococktail.org. From 1967 and the Chapel Production Library, that's a tune from the album Bossalina. It's by Keith Popworth, and it's called Flying Fish. Coming up on the Retro Cocktail Hour, Bing Crosby Goes Hawaiian. In the next 10 minutes, plus we'll hear one from Martin Denny's album Exotica 2. Here's something new by Jazztronic, the nom du disque of Japanese DJ, producer, pianist Ryota Nozaki. The album is Exotica Aloha and features a number of classic Exotica tunes reimagined by Jazztronic. Now, often that can be a recipe for disaster, but here it is most sublime. Here's Les Baxter's Jungle Flower on the Retro Cocktail Hour, Kansas Public Radio.
Come, my love, with me across the sea. Return to paradise. All in life worthwhile is on that I returns to paradise. Velvet moon above evil turns to love, love evermore. Me and find your peace of mind. Return to paradise. above, evil turns to love, love evermore. Come with me and find your peace of mind. Return to
Martin Denny from Exotica 2 in 1957 on the Retro Cocktail Hour. Ebb Tide, composed by Carl Sigman and Robert Maxwell. Before that, Bing Crosby, Return to Paradise. Also, Robert Drasnin from Voodoo 2, the long-awaited follow-up to his classic album Voodoo, done in 1959. And when I say long-awaited, how's 48 years to wait? Well, we find ourselves at the end of the hour. The Retro Cocktail Hour is here from the Underground Martini Bunker with me, Daryl Brogdon. Find out more at RetroCocktail.org. From the University of Kansas, Kansas Public Radio, KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence, 91.5. KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia, 89.7. KANV and KANV HD1 Oldsburg Junction City, 91.3. And KANQ Chanute at 90.3. Everyone can leave a gift to KPR through their will. It's an inspired way to support an organization that's enriched your life and that of others in your community. Learn more about leaving a legacy gift to KPR at legacy.kansaspublicradio.org. www.kpr.org.
You're listening to the Retro Cocktail Hour.
We'll be right back.
That's Gerald Wilson and his swingin' West Coast band from the 1960s with Mambo Mexicana, getting us off the ground for this part of the Retro Cocktail Hour. Daryl Brogdon here, and we're on the air at the Underground Martini Bunker for more of that music that's shaken, not stirred. Hope you're hanging in there, because this hour's got some mighty tasty treats, including Marty Wilson's late 50s classic of big band exotica, Jangala. Also, Hugo Montenegro with music for The Man from U.N.C.L.E. The Brass Impact Orchestra takes on the Beatles. Music for Not-So-Sexy Stripping by Burt Bacharach. And the slinky, sultry sounds of April Stevens. Not responsible for accident or injury, it's the Retro Cocktail Hour on Kansas Public Radio. Marty Wilson and his orchestra from a somewhat unheralded album made in 1959, Jungala. This record is amazing in all respects, a swinging collection of great Afro-Cuban big band jazz. If you can hunt up a copy for yourself, you will not be disappointed. We just heard Jungle Fantasy. Ahead of that on the Retro Cocktail Hour, Old Devil Moon, done by organist Buddy Cole with an assist by Jack Mr. Bongo Costanzo. It's on the album Swing Fever, made in 1960. You've got the Retro Cocktail Hour on the air again from the Underground Martini Bunker with me, Daryl Brogdon. Coming up, the exotic sounds of composer Mike Stoller. With his partner Jerry Lieber, he wrote a ton of top 40 hits back in the day, but later we'll hear an album of his music with a South American flavor. Our show's on the air every week at this time and available on demand at our website. That's where you'll also find playlists. You can sign up for the mailing list, and there's a CD giveaway, too. We're at retrococktail.org. Cuban Strings of Humberto Suarez on the Retro Cocktail Hour. That's called Cucucita. Very glad to have you join us on another voyage around the world of space-age pop and incredibly strange music. I'm Daryl Brogdon here at the Underground Martini Bunker, and later in the hour, the tropical jazz of Nino Nardini, plus Accordion Samba by Jacques Pellerin. Right now, though, here is Giorgio Cucito, an Italian jazz musician who leads a band called Swing Valley back in the old country. His album Exotica is just that, a nice contemporary take on some exotic favorites. And where better to start than Les Baxter's Quiet Village on the Retro Cocktail Hour from KPR.
Thank you.
My Tiki Torch is hot for the Retro Cocktail Hour, a production of Kansas Public Radio.
Support for the Retro Cocktail Hour on KPR comes from Green Lady Lounge, offering live Kansas City jazz 365 days a year till 3 a.m. Green Lady Lounge is located at 1809 Grand Boulevard, Kansas City. Information at greenladylounge.com. And KU Spencer Museum of Art, now showing the exhibition Inked Bodies, which highlights the diverse stories people tell through tattoos. Details at spencerart.ku.edu. That's Swingin' Spy Jazz by Hugo Montenegro, originally for the TV series The Man from U.N.C.L.E. It's called Jungle Heat. Before that, on the Retro Cocktail Hour, Jorge Aquil Tapparino, a composer who was better known as Nino Nardini. He was a frequent collaborator with and the childhood friend of the great composer Roger Roger. And the two of them did a number of albums for various production libraries. We heard Nino on Tropical. Also, Guillerme Viguero with a tune by Mike Stoller called Amazon Moon. Now, Mike Stoller is a music legend. With his songwriting partner Jerry Lieber, they wrote many songs for Elvis, including Jailhouse Rock and Hound Dog. They also wrote classics like Stand By Me and On Broadway. Together, these guys had over 70 chart hits. But what we heard was far afield from the top 40. It was a title tune from Amazon Moon, a lovely album of bossa-flavored tunes from the pen of Mike Stoller, interpreted by Guillerme Viguero. Well, if you've listened to the show for a while, you may know that I am a bit of a sucker for jazz accordion. So it was quite a treat to hear new music by Jacques Pellerin. Jacques' second album is called Back to Philadelphia Volume 2, which you can buy at cdbaby.com. From Back to Philadelphia, here's Rua Samba on the Retro Cocktail Hour, Kansas Public Radio. Thank you. That's Warren Keim and the Brass Impact Orchestra, Eleanor Rigby, from the band's first album on Command Records in 1967. This is the Retro Cocktail Hour on the air from here at the Underground Martini Bunker. I'm Daryl Brogdon. Coming up, saxophonist Sam the Man Taylor from the album Blue Mist, plus singer April Stevens with a song that got her banned from many radio stations in 1959 because of its sexual suggestiveness. We'll get all suggestive in the next 10 minutes. Here's a tune now composed by Burt Bacharach for the movie What's New Pussycat, 1965. It's not the famous title tune, however. This one is called Stripping Really Isn't Sexy, Is It? You decide. On the Retro Cocktail Hour from KPR.
Girl. tell me what to do. This is the first love that I have ever known. What must I do to make you my very own? Teach me, tiger, how to tease you. Wah, 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 wah. Tiger, tiger, I wanna squeeze you. Wah, 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 wah. All of my love I will give to you. But teach me, tiger, or I'll teach you.
Sam the Man Taylor with a tune from the album Blue Mist, 1955. That's called Lonely Love Affair, here on the Retro Cocktail Hour. Before that, April Stevens with Teach Me Tiger. That's from 1959. It was a big hit for April in that year, but it also got her briefly banned from certain radio stations because of its sexual suggestiveness. And it's still pretty steamy. Coming up on the Retro Cocktail Hour, mood music by Jackie Gleason from the album Music, Martinis, and Memories. Here's Crime Jazz Now from the soundtrack of the TV show M Squad. A number of hands contributed musically to this show. Jazz greats Count Basie and Benny Carter, John Williams, and Stanley Wilson, who at the time was head of music at Universal Studios. Here's a tune written by Stanley for the show called Lonely Beat on the Retro Cocktail Hour. Kansas Public Radio.
I see you. The more I want you, somehow this feeling just grows and grows with every sigh. I become more mad about you, more lost without you, and so it goes. Can you imagine how much I'll love you the more I see you? As years go by, I know the only one for me can only be you. My arms won't free you. Oh, my heart won't try. Can you imagine how much, oh, I'll love you the more I see you? As years go by, I know the only one for me can only be you. My arms won't free you. Oh, my heart ain't gonna try.
That's singer Ed Townsend, who, besides being a singer, was also a non-practicing attorney. The story goes that he used his legal training to help other musicians negotiate their contracts. We heard a tune from Ed's first album, New in Town, from 1958. Glad you joined us for the Retro Cocktail Hour, the home of incredibly strange music and space-age pop. I'm Daryl Brogdon with a reminder that you can also hear the show on demand at our website. That's also where we've got playlists from past shows and links to our Twitter feed and our Facebook group. Find it all at RetroCocktail.org. Well, we're not allowed to have any more fun on this show tonight, so we're going to close it up for another week with some classy mood music by the Jackie Gleason Orchestra with trumpeter Bobby Hackett. This is It Could Happen to You on the Retro Cocktail Hour, Kansas Public Radio. Thank you. From the University of Kansas, Kansas Public Radio is KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence, 91.5. KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia, 89.7. KANV and KANV HD1 Oldsburg Junction City, 91.3. And KANQ Chanute at 90.3. Everyone can leave a gift to KPR through their will. It's an inspired way to support an organization that's enriched your life and that of others in your community. Learn more by leaving a legacy gift to KPR at legacy.kansaspublicradio.org.
Hi, this is Steve Inskeep with NPR News. Any good news organization should bring you points of view that you agree with and points of view that you don't. Facts you approve and facts that make you uncomfortable. Our job is to bring you the full picture in context so you can decide. This is NPR.
I'm Maria Lopez. Now here's your weather forecast for the KPR listening area. It's 72 and cloudy. Wind is from the east at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, a few showers with a low in the upper 60s. Wind will be from the east at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Then tomorrow, clear with a high in the mid 80s. Tomorrow night, thunderstorms with a low in the mid 60s. It's 72 and cloudy. Stay tuned for more KPR weather for Northeast Kansas.
It's always a good time when the Tim Whitmer Quartet is in the house. Maybe that's why they're called the Good Time Quartet. I'm David Bassey, and this is live at Green Lady Lounge, where today Tim and his band are on deck to serve up some swinging Kansas City jazz. Besides Tim Whitmer at the keys, this is...